Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Pam Palmiter, and I'm a Mi'kmaq lawyer of about 14 years and member of the Eel River Bar First Nation in New Brunswick. I am an associate professor in the Department of Politics at Ryerson and currently head their Center for Indigenous Governance, and I sometimes testify before the House and Senate on legislation impacting First Nations.
So Bill S2, or Family Homes on Reserves and Matrimonial Interests or Rights Act, was introduced by Minister John Duncan at the end of September and proposes changes that would alter the way matrimonial property rights are applied on reserves. Can you tell us a bit more about what Bill S2 proposes?
Okay, so this is the fourth time around, essentially. Bill S2, like the previous three bills, really purports to create a new one-size-fits-all matrimonial property regime on First Nation reserves. And why is that? Well, Canada says that the primary reason is to fill the legislative gap on matrimonial real property issues on reserve. What is that gap? Well, the gap is that the federal government has created legislation, namely the Indian Act, which controls every aspect of First Nations lives. But they excluded MRP rules, matrimonial real property rules, and on the other side of the coin, the provinces have jurisdiction to legislate with regards to property and civil rights of all provincial residents, which includes a family law dealing with, you know, property and matrimonial homes and support obligations and that kind of thing. But provincial laws cannot apply to Indian reserve lands and property situated on reserves because of the jurisdictional agreement in the Constitution. So there's no independent rules, and Canada considers this to be a legislative gap that needs to be addressed right away. So what Bill S2 purports to do is fill this gap by creating what they consider to be interim rules, which are essentially provincial-type rules, which will apply on reserves and be administered by provincial courts until such time as a First Nation enacts its own rules voted on by the community. So that's kind of the, you know, it'll basically incorporate things like the spouse gets to live in the home during the period of the marriage or the relationship. The spouse is entitled to half the property on the breakdown of the relationship. And, you know, basically similar to what the provincial rules are.
So on your blog, you argued that Bill S2 is a form of backdoor assimilation. Can you expand on this?
Yeah, definitely. Basically, what I'm talking about in terms of backdoor assimilation is that this bill, to me, is literally like a Trojan horse. It rides in portraying itself to be bringing equality to First Nation women, protecting them against domestic violence, but the bill doesn't achieve any of that. Instead, what it does is, for the first time in history, it creates new rights to reserve lands and reserve property for non-Indians. That's in complete contravention and violation of all of the treaties, the Indian Act itself, the Section 35 constitutional provisions, and, of course, the new United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, otherwise known as UNDRIP. So if you think about that for a second, so how does it actually mean assimilation? Well, First Nations have already lost the vast majority of their lands and resources. We know that. All they have left are these tiny little reserves. However, those reserves have been set apart under the Indian Act for, quote, the exclusive use and benefit of Indians. That's what the Indian Act says. Bill S2 doesn't purport to amend the Indian Act. It just completely ignores it. Then you have the situation where some reserves were set up under treaties, which are now constitutionally protected. And as you know, the Constitution is Canada's supreme law. So there's no way that legislation like S2 can amend the Constitution Act. Canada, federal or provincial crown, simply just can't ignore the fact that Indian reserve lands are constitutionally protected. So what'll happen is, if the situation was that Indians were not intermarrying with non-Indians, this wouldn't be an issue. I wouldn't be talking about assimilation. But because of all of the colonial policies, because of the loss of land and the relocations of our communities, our First Nations have moderate to high outmarriage rates, which means they have high relationships with non-Indians. Some First Nations are as high as 80 to 100%. So what does that mean? It means in a very short period of time, if Bill S2 passes, if you combine that high out marriage rate with the high rate of divorce and relationship breakup, these reserves could very quickly turn into white homesteads, i.e. occupied and used by all non-Indians, despite all of the constitutional protections for Indian reserve lands. So that's how I see it really being a form of backdoor assimilation and not about preventing domestic violence at all.
So you mentioned a bit earlier that this is basically the fourth time that this bill has been introduced, and that all of the other bills failed after a near unanimous opposition from Aboriginal organizations, First Nations communities, Indigenous women, and other groups. So why was there such, can you talk a bit more about the broad opposition to this bill in the past and currently?
Yeah, well, the opposition is the same. If you look at any of the testimonies in the House or the Senate from any of the First Nation or Aboriginal witnesses, especially the women who testified, because this is being touted as a, you know, women's rights kind of bill, you'll notice that they have the very same objections to the bill. So first and foremost, the debate, the issue of the gap is being portrayed as a federal and provincial jurisdiction issue, which completely ignores First Nation jurisdiction to enact their own laws outside of the Bill S2 process, because First Nations have an internationally recognized inherent right to be self-determining. And more than that, in 1996, Canada recognized through the inherent right policy that our inherent right to be self-determining was protected in the Constitution. Constitution being the supreme law of the land means that Canada can't be interfering with our right to govern ourselves, which includes MRP laws. So that was the first big kind of common opposition. The second one is that this bill doesn't even give First Nation women what they asked for. So First Nation women and organizations have been going around the international community, to the United Nations, testifying before Senates and committees, saying, listen, there's a problem with not dealing with matrimonial issues on reserve. And the problem is lack of funding for more homes to address the huge backlog, lack of funding for women's shelters, funding for family counseling and preventative measures, and there's no funding and legal supports to help us access lawyers and courts when we need them. And a specific survey was done of First Nation women in shelters about what they wanted out of MRP legislation, if there was to be any. And the number one concern they had was that they didn't want any legislation to be imposed on their communities that did not recognize our Aboriginal and treaty rights. So this legislation, which is supposed to be helping First Nation women, is actually being harmful to First Nation women. And I guess the last kind of common opposition, and I mean there's lots of detailed ones, but is that the Conservatives are just plowing ahead regardless of what we say. Had they listened to us the first time around, we wouldn't be here at the fourth iteration of this bill. So consultation doesn't mean you hear what people say and completely ignore it. Consultation comes with accommodation, which means you have to accommodate our interests. So simply put, we have the fourth edition of this bill that's only here for the fourth time because they haven't listened to all of the very same opposition that we had to all of the other bills. But the difference this time is that the Conservatives are a majority in the House, they're a majority in the Senate, they're quickly making themselves a majority on lots of boards and commissions across the country, and pretty soon our Supreme Court of Canada will be a majority of Conservative people. So they're in a much more powerful position to just impose it on us.
Why do you think this legislation was reintroduced if it was so broadly opposed in the past?
Well, that's a really good question, because in whose interest does this serve? Is this really about providing access to justice for First Nation women? No, of course not, because it doesn't even focus on First Nation women. Why it was reintroduced is, one, because they can. They're the dominant power right now. And two, because they, like any other government, have a very specific policy agenda for all of their legislation. And you'll notice that there's a common theme in all of it. So basically what you have is a Conservative Party that isn't the same party as it was in the Mulroney days. It's now the kind of hybrid party that's merged with the Reform and all the right-wing fringe groups that go with that. And their ideology is based on assimilating Indians. So one of the quickest ways to assimilate Indians, or you know, quote, get rid of the Indian problem once and for all, is to get rid of Canada's responsibility for their two jurisdictional heads, one with Indians and one with lands reserved for Indians. So you have the Indian Act and Bill C-3, which protected Canada's rights to assimilate Indians and to make sure that they would be legislatively extinct in 75 to 100 years. Now you have Bill S-2, which will make sure that over time, and in a very short period of time, most reserve lands will be occupied by non-Indians. And for anybody else who's left, well, there's always Bill C-10 to jail them. So, I mean, if you look at it, it's very, very clear what their agenda is, and that is to assimilate Indians.
So what do you think will happen if this legislation passes, and in what ways might it be challenged?
Okay, so what should happen if we really lived in a just world, First Nations would be provided with a minimum of 3 to 5 years to kind of consider the legislation and what they want to do in their own communities, because after all, it's Canada who created the gap. However, I don't think that's the reality. I think in reality, if this legislation passes, it will further divide communities. It'll make communities turn to litigation instead of traditional dispute resolution mechanisms and leave those communities vulnerable to unscrupulous non-Indians who would like to take their land and property, which is something that the Royal Proclamation, the Indian Act, our treaties, and the Constitution claims to protect us against. So what, in terms of, you know, where do we go from here, I think it could easily be challenged on the sense that it's unconstitutional. They simply do not have the legal authority to pass this legislation, because there's a principle in constitutional law that's very clear. The only way to amend the Constitution is this under the specific provisions in the Constitution, which requires, you know, provincial agreement and that kind of thing. They cannot amend the Constitution simply by enacting new legislation. This legislation not only violates the Indian Act, but it violates the Constitution in the sense that it's dealing with Indian land rights that are protected in the Constitution, and they're protected from this kind of infringement, so they don't have the legal authority to do that. And I think it could be easily challenged on that basis.
So we also wanted to talk to you about Bill C-10, the Conservative government's tough on crime omnibus bill. One of the provisions of this bill would impose mandatory minimum sentences and remove judges' abilities to use discretion when it comes to sentencing. Previously, this has allowed judges to consider all other alternatives to jail and to consider historical circumstances for Indigenous people who are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. How do you think this provision will impact the incarceration rates of Indigenous peoples?
Well, that's a big question, because there are so many problems with Bill C-10. It's really hard to know where to begin. It's my opinion that the Conservatives don't have the ability to remove a judge's discretion. One of the fundamental principles of Canadian liberal democracies is the independence of our judiciary. This means citizens have to follow the rule of law. It means the Canadian government has to follow the rule of law as well. The Conservatives simply just can't legislate their way around laws that they don't like, especially those laws which are meant to address severe consequences of a justice system that's been proven to be racist. So you'll know that there's been, you know, endless studies, reports, government findings, judicial inquiries that have all found over and over again Aboriginal peoples are overrepresented. One, because of the devastating consequences of colonization, but two, because of the ongoing prevalent discrimination in every juncture of our justice system. So from arrest to decision, to charge, to incarceration, to parole, and all of the lack of supports while they are incarcerated. So the Supreme Court of Canada in Gladue was very specific. I mean, they considered that in detail. And what does that mean for an Aboriginal offender? And so they made very specific directions for judges to consider that in order to address the injustice in Canada of the needless overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in jails, is to make sure that judges have the opportunity to consider sentences other than just incarceration. And they have to take into account these unique factors that I just talked about that are relevant to Aboriginal offenders. And they also have to give serious consideration to all of the different sentencing procedures, options, and sanctions based on that person's Aboriginal heritage. So who is the Harper government to say, no, we don't care about overrepresentation and racism in the justice system? In my opinion, that provision could be struck down just as fast as it was enacted, because mandatory sentences will only increase those incarceration rates.
So do you think Bill C-10 and the Conservative government's tough on crime agenda in general is tied to attempts to introduce bills like Bill S-2, which is like attempting to take over First Nations land?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I said before, all of this legislation has a common theme to it. And if you look at all of the legislation that's been introduced in their last session and in the current session, there's a very clear theme overall, which is getting rid of all special rights, and not just for Aboriginal people, but for vulnerable groups like youth and women and mentally disabled, for example. But if you look just at legislation that can impact or does directly impact First Nations people, you see a very clear assimilation goal. So you've got, you know, Bill C-3, which was passed last term, which protected Canada's right to have a disappearing Indian formula under the Indian Act's registration provisions. So we now know, we can calculate with demographic certainty that in 75 to 100 years, there'll be no status Indians left. That means no status Indians, there's no band left. No band left, then they get to have the reserve lands back. But while that's happening, you have now Bill S-2, which will result in the loss of the use of reserve land and reserve property while that assimilation process is happening, because it gets to now be occupied and used by non-Indians. Take that in conjunction with Bill C-10, and we have a gross overrepresentation of our people, men, women, and children, in federal and provincial jail institutions, which will only get worse. We know it will get worse with C-10, with mandatory minimum sentences, for example, because now there'll be no discretion. It'll be mandatory that they go to jail, and they'll be, and knowing that they already get arrested more and prosecuted more and found guilty more than any other segment of society, we know they're going to be incarcerated more. So if one bill doesn't get us, the other bill will. And pretty soon, Canada's not going to have any treaty partners to worry about. They're not going to have any specific claims to worry about. They're not going to have any Aboriginal rights to worry about. And that doesn't serve our interests. It just serves theirs. And so I see a very, very clear policy objective here.
How has Bill S-2 affected Indigenous people?
Well, I think there's other bills that had been introduced before, the accountability bill, which, you know, made First Nations look like they weren't accountable. It was a bill that was promoted on the basis that, you know, First Nations and chiefs and their counselors aren't accountable. They're making millions of dollars on taxpayers' money, so this bill is going to make them accountable. But this bill only did two things. One, it made First Nations have to account for all of their federal funding, which the general public doesn't know, that First Nations are the most accountable communities of all similar communities, including governments in the world. They literally have to account for their money, hundreds of reports, sometimes on average 3 a day. I mean, that's how ridiculous it is. But the thing that it really wasn't about accountability. It was to make the public think that they weren't accountable. But when you looked at the other provisions in the Act, which was a very small bill and hasn't been passed, I should say, is there is a provision in there saying that the protections in the access to information and protection legislation would no longer apply to First Nations. So while federal, provincial, and municipal governments have protection from ATIP, that you don't have to release certain information, it would eliminate that for First Nations. So for every bill that's being promoted as something good, there's always an undermining objective that's harmful to First Nations in all of these bills. And I just think that I would like to hope that the public would, you know, make these connections and speak to their MPs and senators about opposing these bills.
All right. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Dr. Pometer.
No problem.